Hi, I'm Albina Ling.
And I'm Grace Lin.
And we're Book Friends Forever.
We're childhood friends that grew up to be
a children's book editor
and an author and illustrator.
Welcome to Book Friends Forever, the virtue signaling on social media episode. Every week we catch up with each other's lives, talk about what's on our minds, and share with each other what we're grateful for.
And if you enjoy our podcast, please tell a friend about it and check out our website, bookfriendsforever.com. The website will include more detailed show notes as well as links to the episodes.
And please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps with discoverability, so thank you everyone who has already rated and reviewed our podcast.
So, Alvina, how have you been?
Well, I just got back from vacation, and I actually left Brooklyn.
Yes, I saw some of your photos online. They're so beautiful.
So I rented a car, and I went up to Burlington, Vermont, and rented an Airbnb. And so this was the first time out of Brooklyn since March, and it just felt really great. I mean, even the drive felt great because it's such a beautiful drive. You know, so much green, and the skies were so blue with fluffy clouds, which is my favorite. And it's so, you know, I didn't know Burlington was so beautiful.
Aww.
No offense to my Vermont friends, but, I go to Kindling Words, and that's, you know, we fly into Burlington, and it's in, but it's, you know, you take a shuttle straight to Essex and basically just stay in the inn the whole time. And you know, it is beautiful around there, but the thing that I just had no idea about was Lake Champlain and how beautiful it is in the summer. And you know, I didn't know that Burlington had beaches. Like, I had a true beach day, you know, just brought my, you know, sarong and blankets and towels and swam in the lake, and it was, oh gosh, it was blissful.
So, aww, that sounds
already
so lovely.
I'm already making plans to go back. But it was nice. So it was my birthday, so that was the reason for the trip. And
yes. Happy birthday.
Thank you. It was a wonderful birthday. And then right before I left, as I mentioned last week, was our focus meeting or launch meeting. And that went really well. It was, you know, we had Little Brown, I don't know if I've mentioned this, but Little Brown is moving to 3 seasons. We used to be 2 seasons, which is funny to say, but yes, we used to be spring, summer, and fall, winter. And then just last year, at the end of last year, we decided to move to 3 seasons, which is what most of the other big publishers do. And so now we have a winter season, which is January to May. Wait, is that right? No, January through April. And then May through August is summer. And then September through December is fall. And sadly, there is no more spring. I think spring is probably lumped in with summer. But because of that, you know, they gave us less time to present our list. But at the same time, we had acquired, you know, the Disney list. So we actually, and because of schedule issues, you know, we ended up moving a lot of our books to summer from you know, the winter season. So we just had a lot of titles to present. And it went really well, but it was very tight. But
so did you move to 3 seasons because of acquiring all those titles from Disney? Like, you just have that?
That had nothing to do with it. I would say if anything, it had more to do with the acquisition of Perseus.
Okay.
You know, 3 years ago. So yes, I think it's harder on the sales team to sell, you know, a whole season's, you know, if it's 6 months worth of books, as opposed to 4 months worth of books. So, you know, it's something that we had talked about for a long time. To be honest, it's also a burden, I think, editorially and design wise, because, you know, basically all, you know, 6 months worth of books have to be into copy editing at the same time and into production at the same time, and the covers have to be done at the same time. So, you know, it kind of, you know, in an ideal world, we would just have fewer books per season, and then you're kind of, there's more overlap, I think, with scheduling, but it's just a little bit easier in terms of kind of spreading the list out. So
is there a change in the amount of books that you're publishing?
No.
Oh, no.
This summer list just happens to be a little more, you know, just by circumstance, because this is the first time we're doing it. But in an ideal world, it's just the same number of titles that are just spread out over.
Oh, interesting.
Know. Yeah.
I guess I just assumed it was because you had more titles because of the Disney acquisition.
Well, no, this is a Hachette thing. It has nothing to do with young readers. But as I said, it had more to do with Perseus. Added more titles. Because our sales, unlike, say, Penguin Random House, we don't have a children's-only sales force. Our sales force sells all the whole company's books. So.
Oh. I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, we do have kids-specific, for the accounts, like Barnes & Noble and, and Target and Costco, so the national accounts, we have children's specialists. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to selling to the independents, the same sales rep will sell Little Brown Adult, that sells Little Brown Young Readers, that sells Grand Central, that sells Orbit.
Sells
Perseus. Yes.
So do most publishers have a specified children's sales force? Or are they mostly like Little Brown?
I would say that Big Five mostly has... you know what? I'm not actually 100%, so don't quote me on this. But basically, Penguin Random House has a children's only sales force because they publish so many children's books. I'm sure HarperCollins does too, but we're actually really small in terms of children's. We're small. We're the same size as Candlewick in terms of the number of children's books we publish. Mm-hmm. So we just don't have enough titles to support a children's specialist selling to the indies.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure, like SNS, I'm not sure if they have I don't think they have a children's only sales team. And at Macmillan, I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure Harper and, PRH do.
Huh. That's so interesting. Yeah. I had never really thought about that before, but now I'm like, oh, wow.
Maybe we can have a sales person on our podcast as a guest.
Were there any titles that you were specifically excited to present at the Focus meeting?
I'll just mention my four books that I presented, or actually my assistant Rakaya presented one. The sequel to Eva Evergreen. My Magical Witch is coming out next summer, so that was being presented. Peter Brown has a new picture book, and I think we're going to try to do some kind of announcement, so I won't mention the title, but he took a long break from picture books to work on his middle grade, The Wild Robot and The Wild Robot Escapes. So I'm excited that he's doing another picture book. I might have talked about this book when I was on my sabbatical, because I won this auction right before I left, and then it was announced while I was on sabbatical. But it's called Jenny May Is Sad.
I remember that. Tracy Subasak.
Yeah, so that's coming out next June. And then the last book, I think we're also going to try to do some kind of announcement, but I will say it is by Chris Colfer, and it is a exciting new format.
Yay!
So
I'm going to guess a graphic novel, because I'm trying to think about all the different formats.
I know, exactly. So how have you been?
I've been really busy, very busy. But busy in a good way, I feel like even though I've been really busy, I feel like it's not been so overwhelming that, in the beginning of the pandemic, I just felt like, oh, there's so much to do. And now I feel like there's a lot to do, but like every moment is used up.
Yes.
Because I'm doing creative work finally. I'm doing sketches and drawings. I'm actually doing a little bit of writing. So I have my creative time, which I'm so happy that I've been able to carve time for that, then I have the work that I'm doing for Kids Ask Authors, the book club, the book reviewer club. I think I mentioned this last time, but we got about 200 applicants. And so I finally figured out how I was going to do it. I'm going to have four clubs throughout the year. So there'll be a spring club, a fall club, speaking of seasons, right?
Seasons.
So it'll be like
four
seasonal
seasons.
Clubs. Yeah. Yeah. And six kids per club, and so that way as many kids as possible could could do it. Like, I wanted to do like two clubs a season, but I'm afraid that because the way it's looking, it looks like I'm going to have to mail a lot of the books myself and possibly mm-hmm. get a lot of the books myself, just because of the way, I think I mentioned this earlier too, but the way that paper advanced reading copies are kind of not being made so much. So mm-hmm. so I'm realizing it's going to be an expense on my part, which I'm willing to do because I feel very strongly about this, but it's also, I have to be realistic. I can't send like 50 books, you know, every 2 weeks to people, you know, so like, right. So I have to figure out a good balance. So that's why I'm actually going to be starting a Patreon account, a Patreon. And I think we're working on it, but probably in at the end of the summer, we're going to announce a Patreon for the Kids Ask Authors, because I'm hoping if I can get some people to support the podcast, then I can maybe expand the book club, because I would love to expand the book club so much, because right now we end with a kid book review, but I was thinking like it would be so cool if we started with a kid book review, you know, like mm-hmm. and then ended with another one, so it'd be like two kid book reviews like each episode. I feel like that would be really fun, and I'd love to be able to do that. So you know, so it's that. Yep. I've got Craft Camp with my daughter and our pod of kids. I'm working on like a calendar that so I'm doing a Where the Mountain Meets the Moon trilogy calendar. So I decided just to, this is just like a, I've been calling it my pandemic experiment. So mm-hmm. I'm making like a 2021 calendar, and I'm gonna like just print it up myself and sell it and see how well it does.
Nice. That's a it'll good be experiment.
Yeah, like it's like an experience. But like the thing that actually has been taking most of my mental space recently has been thinking about pandemic pods. You know, mm-hmm. I mentioned this before, how like right now the craft camp that I'm running with my daughter, like it's kind of, I podded with two other families, and basically our friend Anna's family, who like lives right down the street, and then my next door neighbor. And so, and we chose kind of each other mainly for because we were just so close together, it's just easy, right? Yeah. And so all our kids can play together without a mask, and that's why they come over and we do craft camp in the mornings here at our place. And it's been working out great, but the truth is they're all different ages. Like my neighbor is almost 13, and Anna's children are like, I think the youngest is 5, and the older one is like a year older than my daughter, you know, like, so it's okay for what we're doing now, but as I kind of see school starting, like, and I'm thinking about in the future, in the fall, like, what will we do? I'm realizing like the pods that I have set up now is not going to work, because they're just all too different for age in terms of education, right? So it's been a lot to think about, because I'm realizing that when the school starts in the fall, I'm pretty sure that it's not going to be full-time school. I probably wouldn't feel comfortable with her going to school full-time, mm-hmm. at least definitely not full-time. And I'm not even sure if I'm comfortable her going, like, one of the options they've been giving is like 2 days a week, you know, and I'm still on the fence about that, right? Regardless, I feel like she's going to need peers on the other days of the week when there's no school. So my idea was to find somebody her age to kind of pod with and to do schoolwork with, right? Like my thought was like, if it's completely virtual, like my ideal situation was like, if it's completely virtual, the school in the fall, that I could pod up with like 3, maybe 4 other families, right? And then each one of us takes the kids for 1 day a week, so we could share childcare. So like I would take the kids on Mondays, and mm-hmm. And Anna's mom will take them on Tuesdays, and you know, Tilly's mom will take them on Wednesdays, you know, so that way we all have time to work, as well as our kids have time to be together, and they're being educated the best we can in this homeschool kind of way, hopefully with the school curriculum, but if not, you know, something we could do it together. And so so I've been kind of spearheading these conversations amongst the parents and that I know, and it's been really it's been challenging, let's say. It's been really challenging, mm-hmm. you know, because everybody has such different expectations, and everybody has such different like aversions to risk, you know, like there's different scales. And the biggest thing though that didn't occur to me until after I kind of was like halfway deep into having all these conversations about pandemic pods is I was looking online and they were saying how the formation of these pods are really kind of racist and exclusionary and classist, you know, because, you know, who are you leaving out? And like a lot of these pods, they can hire teachers and like, and it just makes the haves and the have nots even greater. And like, and I was thinking about it, and I actually think that criticism has a lot of merit, you know, because, you know, the nature of the pod is to be exclusionary, right? That's the way you keep your risk low, right? And that's like, that really goes against what, you know, what we're looking for in terms of community. And we're always talking about inclusion. So it's like exact opposite. And so I kind of feel like creating a pod is kind of against everything that we've talked about or everything that I've kind of wanted for the community. You know, they say it's like anti-Black in some ways, you know, and I'm not really sure what to do. Like, it makes me feel really uncomfortable because I also feel like I don't really have too many other choices. Like, it's either I try to form a pod or I repeat what we did last spring, which means my daughter just stays at home with us all by herself and our chickens, which is not terrible, but you know, I kind of feel like, how long does she go without friends, you know? So I don't know, it's like a very, it's
that's
a very
tough. I mean, I feel like this whole pandemic has uncovered all of our class, economic, racial issues, you know, that we have in this country, you know, because when I think about safety, you also might think like, okay, well, I wouldn't want someone in my pod to be an essential worker, for example, right? And then so that's another can of worms. It's because, complicated.
Yeah, it's really complicated. It's like, yeah, because who you're leaving out is,
right, tend to be, and that's why, yeah, Black and Latinx people have suffered more from COVID-19 because they tend to be the essential workers. I don't envy you. So what, like, when are you going to make a decision? Do you know, like, do you have a time limit?
Right now, like, I've been talking to about 8 or 10 parents, and I put it out to them, and I can't say that they're, I can say there's about 3 out of the 10 parents, the 10 families, I would say there's about 3 that are pretty vocal, and the rest are just kind of like waiting to see what's going to happen. But I put it out to them like, you know, I've been reading all about how these pods are exclusionary, you know, and what do you think we should, do you think there's something, I think we just have to accept the fact that this is not going to be fair, you know, like there's just no way we can make this fair, but is there a way that we can make it more fair, or, you know, or less unfair, you know, like what is the best we can do in this situation, you know?
And I mean, so, it's almost like the school needs to kind of say, look, you know, if people don't feel like they're safe coming back to school, then here's a sign-up sheet if you want to be in a pod, and then maybe it's almost,
yeah,
you know.
That's exactly what that's exactly what I proposed to the families. I said, what do you say? Because right now, within, like, I would say the 10 families that I've been talking to, we're at the point where, like, okay, one of the parents is going to make a survey, and everybody who's interested in a pod is going to fill it out, and that survey will zone each family of like where they are on the risk scale, so that way you can see like, oh, I'm in the yellow zone, and you'll see who else is in the yellow zone, and then you could see who pods up, right, who you could pod with. I'm in the red zone, so those are the families in the red zone, so I can try to pod up with them. And so I said, what do you say once we get this survey made, we give it to all the third grade classes, right? All the third grade families, you know, and offer to see who wants to be a pod. We get everybody like zoned up. And then I said, what do you say after we're all zoned up if we pair up by lottery, you know? And like, that seems like a fair thing, you know, but, you know, and I offered that out there and it was like crickets though. Mm-hmm. So it was like, don't know if that's going to go over, but, and even my husband's like, I don't think they're going to go for that, you know, but it's just so hard because.
It's so hard. I mean, I think we mentioned this before, but I know like some places in Canada and New Zealand, you know, just in terms of the coronavirus and the pandemic, at a certain point they said, okay, you can open your bubble, you know, times two. Mm-hmm. And of course it's going to be like, will you be my lab partner? And, you know, like getting turned down or, not, you know, like trying to find.
Yeah.
No, it's this weird, like.
It becomes kind of clicky. Yeah. See, that's why I was like, what do you say we just do it by lottery? Because then it's not clicky. It's not like, you know, you know, like.
And but then it is also like, well, at some point, though, it's like you don't, you know, you you want to be with your friends.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, that's the whole thing.
That's part of the point, right?
Yeah. It's like, but if we're only going to be with like three people, we want to make sure it's the people they like, you know, like, and all this thing. And I completely understand. It's and like so personalities hard. And like, I completely, completely understand. And I see both sides. I'm just trying to think of solutions. And I can't, this is one of those situations where it can't be just one individual trying to make a difference, you know?
So has the school decided for sure what they're doing?
No.
It's so interesting, and because the whole country is dealing with this right now. You know, in New York City, I think what they're doing is part-time, but then it is like, well, if there's no childcare, you know, how do parents work and how do parents go back to work? And it's just it's such a mess. Well, I guess we should move on to the topic, which is semi-related, but yes, we're calling this virtue signaling on social media. And, you know, this topic came to mind after George Floyd's murder and then the social movement that arose and its aftermath, including the, you know, that hashtag Blackout Tuesday Instagram exercise, you know, corporations, including my own, posting statements around Black Lives Matter and more. And then, Grace, you brought my attention to this Medium essay by, not sure how to pronounce her name, Shessa Garbutt, entitled Black Lives Matter is Not a Design Choice. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that essay?
When the uprisings first started to happen, a lot of people in, I guess, in the art world and the design world, they started, like, putting up, doing all this artwork, like, with black, like, you know, like a black hand and a white hand in, like in class together, you know, and like, mm-hmm. or like picture, like portraits of George Floyd, you know. And a lot of them were people who had never taken any social justice stand before ever, you know. And it just kind of, I'm not sure exactly what it was, but it just kind of rubbed me the wrong way. Mm-hmm. And I would see, because so many people are just so talented and so wonderful, and I completely understand the intention of it, but it just kind of rubbed me the wrong way that, like, they would do this beautiful portrait of George Floyd, and they would get all these, like, likes and retweets and be like, oh, that's amazing, and you know, and I'd see this portrait, like, retweeted, like, 3,000 times, and it would be usually a white artist, who, like I said, who never had taken any social justice kind of stances before. And I kind of felt like, this is kind of weird. I know the intention is probably not this way, but what you're doing is you're taking the pain of this movement and you're actually using it to push forward your career, you know, like that's right. That's what you're like, you might not mean
and
to
in a way you're centering yourself over the movement and like the pain.
Like, you might not mean to, but you are basically profiting off of this pain, you know. And but I didn't know how really to say it until I read this article, which is like, Black Lives Matter is not a design challenge, you know, and George mm-hmm. Floyd is not a portrait exercise, you know, and this moment is not about you. That's from the article. And then when I read it, I was like, yeah, okay, that's what was bothering me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's, you know, what's tough is that I think that a lot of people feel helpless. And so, you know, you want to do something. And so if the something that you can't know how to do is to paint or design, then I get why that might be your natural inclination to kind of like show like your allyship, or, you know, feeling like you're doing your part to like spread the good word or something mm-hmm. like that. So I can see that too. Yes, I mean, I know that, you know, for example, and I've talked about this on the podcast already, but about when we were putting out a statement, and it's a little bit of, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Yeah.
Because I saw so many posts of people saying, don't just put a black square, you know, mm-hmm. on your Instagram. But then other people saying like, silence is complicity. And, and so it's like, well, you know, it's hard to know the balance.
It's hard because you don't know what to do, but like slowly as I've been thinking and thinking about it, I'm kind of feeling like I do think silence is complicit, right? Mm-hmm. And I feel like it is important to share on social media and talk about where you stand, because I do think that's where I do think that like they're paying attention. Like the more people mm-hmm. who are retweeting these things, the more people who are saying certain things, I think they being like the government, like the politicians, like they're paying attention. They're trying to see the temperature of the population. And if the population seems to be all going towards more progressive ideas, then they'll lean that way, right? So mm-hmm. so it does matter that we say something and we show the politicians that we are leaning on which direction we want them to go. But at the same time, I feel like the difference is, to me, this is, and I've been thinking about this for a long time, if your post profits you more than a black person, then I think you're making the wrong choice. Does that make mm-hmm. sense?
That makes sense. Yeah, I think when I was thinking about this, I think another difference is, you know, some people posted that black square and that was it, right? Mm-hmm. And then they never posted or retweeted or anything again, you know, so they posted the black square just to say, look, I'm on your side. Mm-hmm. But that's the problem, I guess, with social media and being quote unquote performative, because maybe they are doing a lot behind the scenes and they're not tweeting about it or they're not posting about it. So I think that's what's tricky about it. So, you know, it's hard. So, okay. I was also thinking about when you said kind of promoting, you know, black voices, for example. So Little Brown publishes, you know, we publish a very diverse list that I'm very proud of. Mm-hmm. And we publish a lot of black authors, and, you know, we do promote and market and publicize those books, you know, throughout the years. And then when this happened, it was like that weird criticism of like, you know, why aren't you kind of, you know, why aren't you uplifting black voices? But then it's also like, oh, you're just profiting from mm-hmm. uplifting these books.
Voices now. Yeah.
So it's like, where is the balance and how, you know, I mean, I do think the proof is like looking at, oh, okay, they promoted, you know, there are some authors who said, oh, you know, the only other time my publisher has ever tweeted about my book was on, you know, Pub Day, and then nothing in the, mm-hmm. you know, 5 years since. So mm-hmm. that's, I guess, is evidence that, okay, this publisher is not, maybe uplifting mm-hmm. Voices all the time. So I guess the proof is like looking and saying like, oh, okay, you know, this publisher has published diverse voices all along, you know, they promoted but it's just tricky, because it's also, you know, that Martin Luther King Jr. quote of it's never, I'm gonna butcher the actual quote, but it's never the wrong time to do the right thing.
I would see someone painting their George Floyd portrait, you know, and posting it mm-hmm. and getting thousands of likes and feeling kind of like, ooh, that feels weird, but then at the same time saying, well, you know, at least they care, right? Like, and it's good mm-hmm. that at least if they care now, that's good. I think maybe
they're paying attention.
Yeah, yep. Maybe they're paying attention, you know, like, and maybe it's not so much what they did right then. It's like, what are they doing now, you know, mm-hmm. down the line, and what are they going to do next year?
So the quote by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is, the time is always right to do the right thing.
And I think that's a good quote. But I guess the thing is, like, what's the right thing sometimes, you know?
Right. Yeah, it's, you know, so I was thinking, when I was thinking about performative, I was also thinking about, well, you know, I think at the beginning of Facebook and also Instagram, there is this pressure to say, on Mother's Day, you post a beautiful, loving post about your mother, right? Mm-hmm. And you, you know, and then, you know, on someone's birthday or, you know, on your anniversary. And I mean, that's lovely. But then you, I don't know. I remember I used to on Facebook do that at the beginning, and then I just stopped because I felt performative. I felt like it's Mother's Day. I should post about all the mothers I know. And it's funny because sometimes I see couples, and when they post a loving, like, it's my husband's birthday and he is, you know, the best thing that ever happened to me. And I this is terrible, but in the back of my head, I think they don't have a good marriage, which is terrible. But I mean, that's what I mean about performative. Like, it's almost mm-hmm. like you feel obligated to do that. And I know celebrities especially, you know, like, because yeah. people are always picking their lives apart. And if they don't post about their significant other, then everyone's going to assume that they broke up. And mm-hmm. it's just complicated.
It is complicated. But, well, I'd like to dissect the idea of virtue signaling. I mean, even beyond performative. I think that's such an interesting idea, because I remember when I started Kid Lit Women, there was a couple people, and one woman in particular, who was extremely, extremely angry at me. I remember she felt that I was just virtue signaling, and the people that were part of this were virtue signaling. All we were doing was trying to talk about these issues to help promote ourselves, you know? Mm-hmm. And I remember feeling, obviously I felt really hurt by that, right? And I tried really hard to be honest about it, you know? And I was like, am I? And then I was like, maybe I am. But maybe it doesn't matter. You know, like, it's like all these like things, like, it's because the truth is, like, well, if you're really virtuous, then you don't need to signal it, right? You don't have to tell anybody about it. Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, it doesn't, maybe it doesn't, I don't know. But then I felt like, but the whole point of what we were trying to do was to create change, and to create change, you need to like share it and bring attention to it, you know? So I don't know. It was a very interesting dilemma. Obviously, I feel like there must be something in me that is searching for some kind of approval and wants to do some kind of leadership. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing this, right? So, mm-hmm. But does that mean it's bad? That's where I struggle because there's a part of me that thinks it's true. I am looking for a certain amount of approval, like, but I don't know if that's a bad thing or not, you know?
I think it goes back to, you know, what we've talked about before about, you know, what motivates us. Mm. And in a way, you know, being motivated by jealousy or being motivated by negative emotions is not a good thing, but it can still result in very good work. Yeah. And I think, you know, I think when it comes to kind of social issues, I just feel like it's more important to act and to speak and to do rather than not. You know, I do think it's much better to speak up than to be quiet. So you know, I do think that, you know, we can explore our motivations all we want. But I think in some cases you just have to be okay with, you're not going to please everyone. Some people are going to be upset, but you know, it's better to do something than to not. All right. And now we'll end, as we do every week, with what we're grateful for. I'll start this week. So I am grateful for the beauty of nature. When I was in Vermont, I went on a hike up to Camel's Hump, which is the third highest peak in Vermont. And I didn't actually know the hike was going to be as challenging as it was, but it was just really satisfying and it was really beautiful. So, you know, I'm just grateful for just being in nature, you know, Lake Champlain and being on the beach. Like, I'm all about water. So whenever I'm like by the beach or a lake and hear the sounds of the water. I'm just really happy. So that's what I'm grateful for. Grace, what are you grateful for?
I'm grateful for central air conditioning. It's been so hot. Like yesterday it was like 98 degrees and today it's like 97 degrees out. And before moving to this house, like we always lived in like old places that like always had the air conditioner in the window and everything like that. And this is the first house or first place I've ever lived in that had like central air conditioning. And like I have a lot of, as any longtime listeners know, I have a lot of like issues about my house, right? Because it's not, it's probably not what my late husband Robert, who is an architect, would consider anything. He probably wouldn't consider it beautiful at all. But the thing that is nice about it is that, you know, it's really, really new, modern in the sense that it's like, got all the central air and central heating and like all those like very practical, nice things to have. And mm-hmm. So I'm very, very grateful for that because Yay. Honestly, it's so hard. Like one of the things that's so nice is that like I do get a lot of work done. Like now, like I'm drawing and I'm even starting to write a bit. Like, and the truth is I do that because I can do it because I'm comfortable. Like I feel like when I'm really hot or like really like when I'm really hot or like physically uncomfortable, it's really difficult for me to do those things in a very productive way. And the fact that I have like a good temperature in my house is like, phew, I feel like, you know, I can just work. So it's really
that
nice.
Kind of can loop back to our earlier discussion about inequity in education and how, you know, there's so many children who don't have that or and also don't have enough food to eat. And, you know, yes, it makes it much harder to learn and to be productive.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So, yeah, I mean, those are all the things. So I'm grateful for the privilege of having that. But we turn it back. It's like, so does that mean I shouldn't have air conditioning because not everybody can have air conditioning? You know, like it's such a hard thing.
No, I think when it, like, for example, when it comes to healthcare, it means everyone should have it.
Yeah.
Not that everyone should not have it.
Yeah, see, like it's...
Everyone should have it.
I know, so...
Universal healthcare. And now here's our two-minute book review segment featuring Allison Morris, Senior Director of Title Selection at First Book.
Hello, book friends. This week, I want to highlight a picture book biography that I think is a true celebration of a Black artist, and I'm going to actually do the same thing with a different book next week. This is a book by a Black author and Black illustrator. It is Dream Builder, the story of architect Philip Freelon, written by Kelly Starling Lyons and beautifully illustrated by Laura Freeman. It was published earlier this year by Lee & Loeb Books. And for anyone who's not familiar with Philip Freelon, he was the lead architect hired to design the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C., not too far from where I'm recording this right now. That project was really the pinnacle of Phil's career and the culmination of his lifelong commitment to the struggle for social justice. This is a book that I think works for readers of all ages. It offers an insightful and interesting overview of Phil Freelon's life and career, starting by introducing readers to a really relatable kid whose early encounters with art and proud connections to his Black family, community, and history would help later shape the places he would create. And those are places that, to quote the book, help people, that show everyday beauty, that celebrate heritage and fill hearts with joy. Tragically, Phil Freelon died last year at the age of 67, but he thankfully lived long enough to be part of this book's creation, and he hoped that it would be a way to inspire more kids of color to consider architecture as a career. You can help make that happen by introducing the kids you know to Dream Builder, the story of architect Philip Freelon, written by Kelly Starling Lyons and illustrated by Laura Freeman. I'm Allison Morris. That's Allison L. Morris on Twitter and Kidlit Girl on Instagram. Thank you for listening and have a great week.
Thanks for joining us, and thanks to Hachette Book Group, Hachette Audio, Little Brown Books for Young Readers, and Alex at PC Work Studio for producing and editing this podcast. You can find me at Planet Alvina on Twitter and at Alvina Ling on Instagram.
And I'm at Pacey Lynn on both platforms. We love hearing feedback, so keep tagging and messaging us on social media using the hashtag BookFriendsForever or send us a message via our website, bookfriendsforever.com. You can also see more detailed show notes there.
And if you have any suggestions for future topics to cover, please let us know. And of course, please remember to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. And if you like this podcast, please tell a friend about it. I'm Alvina Ling.
And I'm Grace Lynn.
Have a great week.
And don't forget to read.
Bye.